Good morning. I will bring the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee to order. Representative O'Driscoll, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from March 24th?
No, Madam Chair, I haven't. I defer to someone else.
All right.
Madam
Chair.
There
you go. Representative Albright.
I would make a motion that we accept the minutes from the March 24th meeting.
Representative Albright moves the minutes of March 24th. Any discussion? All those in favor of approval of the minutes of March 24th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are adopted. Just a note to the committee that if we do not finish this morning, we will reconvene around 5 o'clock in room 10. Room 10 at 5 p.m. Representative Howe, we are going to, I will approve House File 3124, but that be laid over. 3123. Representative Howe, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee for hearing the bill. This bill, actually what we're looking to do is change the method, or actually just try to eliminate as many special elections for school boards, so our educational tax dollars go to educating kids instead of holding special elections. And Madam Chair, I believe I would like to entertain the which amendment is it? Is the A2 amendment?
All right, Representative Howe, you want to do amendments before we hear from testifiers? Is that your wish?
I would prefer to actually amend it before we hear testifiers, and then they can testify to the amendment and the bill all in one.
All right, very
Madam
well.
Chair? Madam Chair?
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the A2 amendment.
All right. Representative Albright has moved the A2 amendment. Discussion? All those in favor of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The A2 is the House File 3123 has adopted onto it the A2 amendment. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the original bill, what it did was make it so that you could appoint, the school board could appoint, if they had a vacancy, appoint another member, and you'd have basically until the next general election to elect a school board member. What this amendment does is give the voters a say, and if the public does not like the school board member they appoint, that they would be able to basically do a recall on that appointed member. So I don't know if we do it anywhere else in government, but what it does do is give the people a voice and make sure that they're heard, that at least they get someone that is acceptable to them. So with that, I don't know if I got any testifiers or not today.
Representative Howe, do you want to go through the other amendments first, or do you want to...
We can go through the other amendments, Ms. Madam Chair, if that's what you'd prefer to do, and then hear the testimony.
Why don't we do that?
All right.
That's all right with you?
Absolutely.
There is an A3 amendment. Representative Lane?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I see that you already amended the bill to have, if people don't like the appointee, there would be a recall election. Is that what I'm understanding it to be?
Representative Howe.
Basically, yes, there would be then what would be done is then there would require a special election must be held in that next November.
If I could, I'll have a House Research comment on that. Mr. Gearing?
So Madam Chair, Representative Lane, how the A2 amendment, what it does is provide a process for the voters to petition to effectively reject an appointee that's been appointed by a school board. So they would have 30 days after an appointment is made by the board to file a petition saying that they reject the appointee that's been made. That petition would have to be signed by at least 5% of the total number of voters voting at the most recent state general election. And if that petition is filed properly, then what would happen is the school board would be required to appoint a new person to fill the vacancy. There wouldn't be a recall or other elections process. It would just be effectively a rejection of the original appointee.
Okay. Representative Lane.
Thank you. Well, my amendment here suggests that in you, when you're doing the appointment, and this is actually what was actually part of the 2015 law that we are now changing back because of all the special elections, but there's one paragraph in there that suggested that when you do make an appointment, you have 30 days in which you will have a public hearing on that before you're making the appointment. I think that to make sure that the public has a part in who is being appointed, some say in that, that you're hearing from the people, then it doesn't have the feel that perhaps four or five members on a board are just appointing somebody that they chose. There is nothing in law now that says they need to do this. It is just the point. It causes some consternation when people say, but we should be involved. I know that some school districts, perhaps many of them, do make it a public process in some way, but this says that they need to do it and they need to notify people and they need to make sure that people are aware that there is this appointing going on and that there is this opportunity to participate in a public hearing on it. It just makes it much more transparent rather than just a few people appointing somebody to work with them. What you have here then is an after the fact. If you didn't like somebody, then you could, with 5% of the voters who had voted in the previous election, ask for you to do it over again. But maybe this would stop it and be preventative. If you just did it in a public manner in the first place, it may be not necessary so much to worry about the A2 amendment. So I would just like it to be a public process that we just say that if you're going to appoint somebody, you notify people that you're going to do so and that you have a public process to doing that, give a public hearing to it.
Great, thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Howell. So if I read this, they make an appointment. The school board makes an appointment to fill a vacancy. They've got 30 days for a process that for members to put a petition up, a recall petition, say they're successful, then the school board can reappoint somebody else. That triggers another 30-day period, and that could be thrown out, and so they could basically continue doing this until the regular election period, and then, you know, this could go on for 2 years, going forward to the next election cycle. I guess I think that's a little stretch to saying that would happen, but it could happen where you have a series of members that are appointed and people are, I don't like them for whatever reason, and get a petition up and get enough voters up to knock them out. And so the school board would constantly be going through this process of reappointing and having people thrown out.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Nelson. I firmly believe that the effort to go through that, I think, will prevent most of that from happening. But at least if they have someone that's not palatable to them, there is a process to remove them. I don't know. I think what we have in many cases right now is with these off-year school board elections, participation is not very robust, should I put it? And I think that I've seen figures to where it's some of these elections have cost upwards of over $300 a vote for some of these special elections. I think that if they've got someone that's very much not palatable, that they can go through the process, to think that they're going to go through that process over and over again, I just don't think that that's going to happen. The other piece that I see on the next amendment is that some of the problems that we have with that language is it requires all of these folks, all these public officials, to be notified. Well, I will say that you can take some of these folks, there's upwards of probably 50, 60 people that have to be notified. So the school board folks have got to go and look up all of these people, notify these people, and most of the folks have no interest in what happens at that level anyway, because they're all involved in their own, I mean, they got interest, but they're elected their own position, and to think that the school board has to go back and look up 50, 60 names and make sure they're on the notification list, and oh, by the way, if they forget someone, Now they're in violation of the law. That's, I guess, the problem that I have with the current A3 amendment.
Representative Lane.
Madam Chair, thank you. I left that last sentence, or two sentences in there, because I thought there was some reason why it was put in there in 2015 for maybe rural areas or something. Maybe it was important to get the notification out there. But if that is the stickling point, I am willing to end after 1.7, after the word vacancy. Just cut out the last two sentences. That's fine with me. My point is to just have a public hearing when you do the appointment process.
Representative Howe, are you amenable to, are you offering an oral amendment?
Yes, please.
Representative Howe, any reaction to that? Or I don't know if you're testifiers, I don't know.
Madam Chair, could you just repeat the amendment, the proposed amendment?
The Lane amendment would be to, on lines 1.7, after the word vacancy, after that, where that period, after the period, delete everything after that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, as I look at the Lane amendment, before the verbal amendment, I guess I'm wondering if we aren't entering in at our own peril to a confusing situation with the previous sentence before that, where it denotes, before making an appointment, the board must also notify other public officials in the school district of the vacancy and the expected appointment, including county commissioners, town supervisors, and city council members. Would it be the intention of the author of this amendment to delete that sentence as well?
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's the notification part that seems to be the problem, because, and if you just left the first part, notify other public officials, who would they be and what would that list encompass, and as Representative Howe said. So the point is to just simply have a public hearing, which would be posted, and people would have the notice of that, and other public officials and the public constituents would be able to come. I don't think we need to leave that some public officials should be involved. If we're going to take out the whole thing, that's fine, to just remove those last two sentences.
You good with that, Representative Albright?
Madam Chair, then I would understand that the motion, the Lane motion, would be to strike the last two sentences of this amendment, Madam Chair?
Are you asking if that's what we're doing? Are you?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank
I believe
you.
That's correct. Am I? Yeah. House Research is shaking their head. Yes. So on line 1.7, after the period behind vacancy, you just delete everything after that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
Could House Research or staff explain to me how that would work with the A2 amendment with the 30 days, both of them being 30 days, which comes first?
Okay, good question. Mr. Gearing?
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, the A3 amendment that Representative Lane is proposing would require effectively that the school board have a 30-day period before they make an appointment, so that would come first. So you have a vacancy, and then they would be required within 30 days of the vacancy to hold this public meeting to take input. And then once they've held that meeting, then they can actually make the appointment of someone. And once they make the appointment, then your 30-day period would begin to run, where the voters could petition to have the person removed. So Representative Lane's 30-day period would begin first, and then yours would come next.
Representative Howe.
You know, I'm a guy that likes to keep things simple. And this just... For the school board to try to figure out how this is going to flow, I think is going to be very complicated. I'm a keep it simple, stupid kind of guy, and this to me makes it complicated myself. And I appreciate having public involvement, and I think that's what the A2 amendment does, gives them an option and gives them involvement. So I think the A3 amendment is kind of unnecessary.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was on a school board for 10 years, and during this 30 days, you would have probably two board meetings. The public hearing could be held in conjunction with one of the board meetings. It's really not onerous. It's just simply that if you're going to appoint somebody, give the public a chance to talk about it.
Okay, Representative Hornbeck.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I mean, I think I agree with Representative Howe. I mean, to some extent, this is a way more intimidating process than filing for election, because all of a sudden, you know, you've got a public hearing, you have to tell who you are. I mean, I think this is going way beyond, and I think you're going to chill a lot of folks' interest in being in the process.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lane.
I think that's a misunderstanding of what's going on here. Actually, you have to realize that this paragraph has been in law now for a year. It is actually in law. All the school districts who have had these special elections, that is the problem, because they're held in the middle of nowhere. In my area, we have two right in a row. One was ended in January 28th, and the other one is still going on. Will end April 5th. They were back to back. It's absurd. It's a costly thing. It's not what the school district needs to be doing when they're doing education, not elections. So I'm wholeheartedly in favor of changing this. I've had my own bill on this, but this idea of having a public hearing is not to vet the person. It's to let the public have a say in the process. So this has been going on all along. This whole year, any school district that's had a the special elections would be different, but it has had before this, anybody who's had a process to do a appointing has said to me that they've actually done this, but it's not in law. So I'm just saying that if it's good enough for some areas to actually have a public hearing before they do an appointment to get ideas from the public, we'd like to see this, we'd like to see that, we want to make sure that you're aware of this need, be sure you cover that, whatever. It's not to vet a human being, it's to vet the process. This is just a putting in law that you should make sure that the public is aware that you're going to do an appointment and have some say in what they would like to see in that. It isn't to vet a person that's running.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
That's great that you say that, Representative Lane, but when you look at it, it basically says on line 1.7, relating to the qualifications of the prospective appointees to fill the vacancy. So although that's your discussion, that's not apparently what's going to be in law.
Thank you. Any more discussion on the A3? Seeing none, all of those in favor of adopting the A3, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. The motion is not adopted. There's an A4 amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
That's my amendment. And what this does is it tries to align, reduce the cost, which I think is what we're looking at here, what Representative Howe is looking at here. But if a vacancy occurs more than 90 days prior to the normal fall general election, that it would be the special election be held in conjunction with the general election, and if it falls after that date or less than 90 days, then it would and in the third year of the term, that the appointment would be made, and that then the person would serve till the end of that term that they've been appointed to. And again, this is to save money for this and cut down on the number of special elections. And that's what the amendment does. And I move the A4 amendment.
Representative Nelson moves the A4. Further discussion on the A4?
Madam Chair.
Representative Rumbeck.
If I could, Representative Nelson, so if a vacancy occurs in the second year of the four-year term, then you're okay with an election, a special election? Is that what this
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Hare. Yes, and this would just kind of cut one out at the very end. And like I said, if it's in the third year of their term and it's less than 90 days before a special or regular election, again, this would basically hit the people that have off-year elections, odd-year elections instead of opposed to the even-year elections, that this would save some money again for those school districts. Again, if the idea is to try and keep money in the classrooms as opposed to having to go to run special elections, this would leave more money in the classroom and cut down on the number of special elections.
Madam Chair,
Representative Rumbeck.
Senator Nelson, I'm not sure how many it would cut down on. I mean, if it occurs in the first, second, or third year of the term, you'd still have a special?
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Rumbeck. Then they would all be in November, is the way the law the bill is currently read, they'd be held that November. So if it's less than 90 days before the normal general election in November, then they would push them through. And again, only if it's in the third term, would push them through the next year. So this would only save a few, but it would save, line them up on our normal election day, where we do have bigger turnout than special elections that are held, say, on the special election I ran on March 5th. People aren't used to going out to those days, and so you spend a lot of money on an election and a lot of cost per vote, as was pointed out here by Representative Howell. This would line them up with November, when most people are accustomed to voting in November, more so than any other time of the year.
Representative Howell? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Rembeck, you still have the floor.
Just, Madam Chair, then maybe you were going to ask to Representative Howell, but I wonder if we could find out how this jives with the A2, right?
Mr. Gehring?
Yours?
Madam Chair and Representative Runbeck, I'd have to piece them all together. I think the two amendments would still probably work together, because there'd still be a process potentially where you'd have appointments that could be rejected. So Representative Howe's amendment that would allow an appointee to be rejected by petition could still work, even though in this case you're requiring special elections in certain circumstances. So there might be some drafting things that would have to be fixed, but I think the policy probably could work together.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, Representative Nelson, I think this is a step in the right direction, and it helps eliminate a few of them, but I don't believe it goes far enough. And I think the current language that we have in front of us does a much better job of eliminating more of those special elections and saves the school districts much more money. So I would prefer to go that direction.
Further discussion on the A4.
Madam Chair?
Representative Rembeck.
I'm hearing the term special election being used, sounds like to talk about a November election. Is that a special election if it's in November?
Mr. Gehring?
Madam Chair, Representative Rembeck, yes, so it's possible that you'd have a general election running simultaneously with a special election, and in this case it's called a special election because it's an election to fill a vacancy. So the technical term for that is a special election.
Okay, Madam Chair, but in this case, it's really, if you're having elections anyway, then it's not any additional big deal, it seems to me, but correct?
Madam Chair.
Yep. Representative Nelson.
And that's, Madam Chair, that's the point of the selection of the A4 amendment. It would move that special election to run concurrent with a general election that was being held in November. So if you're a school board and you normally have an election in November, it would line up with that. Otherwise, it would push it back to the next general election. So again, they would be holding an election in a different time than the normal November election. And again, that would save money because the school district could be running it and sharing the cost with the general election that's going on anyway. So that's where the cost saving comes from, Madam Chair.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't believe that we have an election every November. Is it every year we have an election regardless of I do believe there's some Novembers we don't have elections, and we'd in effect have that cost again, and that's what we're trying to avoid.
Further discussion on the A4. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A4, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The A4 is not adopted. To your bill, Representative Howell, are you ready for some testifiers?
Yes, Madam Chair.
I think looks first on our agenda is Tammy Martin. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Tammy Martin, Madam Chair and esteemed committee members, thank you for entertaining my time, and I'll stay to my script so I don't waste any of your valuable time. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you this morning about the legislative changes that were made to the special election last year. My name, as I stated, is Tammy Martin. I am the superintendent at the GFW School District, and I am in support of the bill that you are talking about today. GFW, given Fairfax Winthrop, is a school district who serves 800 pre-K through 12th grade students. We are located on Highway 19 between New Ulm and Hutchinson. I'd like to share with you how the changes requiring a special election for any school board member who has more than 1 year left on their term impacted our district this year. In August of 2015, one of our school board members moved to Texas and had to resign her position on the school board. She had 16 months left on her term. We immediately began the process of looking into what we had to do to meet the new requirements of the state statute. Since it was August, we could no longer utilize the standard process for voting in November because the timeline was too short. Instead, we had to navigate through the requirements on our own and bear all of the costs associated with it. Our first hurdle was to even find a candidate who was willing to file for the position. When given Fairfax and Winthrop consolidated into one school district, they had the foresight to establish board member boundaries that required each designated area to have two board seats. Even though we advertised in both print, on our website, and on the radio, we did not get a candidate who met the boundary requirements until the last day of filing. Knowing that every penny we spent meant less funding for our students, we tried every way we could to control costs, but we still had to rely heavily on the assistance of the county, and they had to recoup their expenses. They took care of our absentee balloting, balloting at nursing homes, and our area trainings. Our only cost savings we could do was to reduce the voting requirement to the 3-hour minimum. We held our special election in January 26th of 2016. It was the earliest date we could find that met the state statute time parameters and did not interfere with other county, city, and township meetings. Because our district serves 5 different counties, this became quite difficult. At the conclusion of the election, we ended up with a total of 34 votes. The cost for printing, county services, election judges, and district employee time totaled $12,166.73. That equates to $357.85 per vote. I'm sure that the intent of the changes last year were not to burden school districts with additional costs, but as you can see from my testimony, that is exactly what did happen. I hope you will consider amending the state statute so other districts do not have to endure the same kind of hardship in the future. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for Ms. Martin? Thank you for your testimony. Bill Holmgren. And on deck is James Hager. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Holmgren. I'm the Director of Finance and Operations for Columbia Heights School District, right here in the metro area. I want to thank you for giving me time to testify on this important topic, and Columbia Heights Public Schools definitely supports House File 3123. What happened to us this past year is we actually had 2 resignations in a 5-month period. First happened in July. Our first member moved out of the district and had to resign. So this is only a couple weeks after the new law went into effect. Because of the new law, we had to run a special election with 17 months left on that particular term. The election took approximately 6 months to complete, leaving the new member now only 10 months to serve before they have to run for re-election. When the second resignation occurred, the district now was short 2 board members. And so for a period of 5 months, we only had 4 members on our board. We are still holding elections. Our final election is next Tuesday, so we're kind of excited about being done with our elections because we had to do a primary on each one of them. So we actually had to run 4 different elections. Because of the... I guess I want to talk a little bit about some confusion when we look at our community. Because of the timing, the members or the candidates who ran in the first election also ran in the second election, just in case they won the first election. So the community seeing the same candidates on both elections really was confusing to the members of the community. I do have a handout. I should have mentioned that right away, if anybody's interested. There's really only the main reason I have a handout. I wanted to kind of show the overlap of the elections, the amount of time that our staff had to put everything into place to run these 4 elections, because only just about 6 weeks into the first election, we started the second election. Next, I guess there's been a lot of talk already about the cost, so I'll just briefly touch on the cost. In order to run the four elections, we did budget $30,000 to run that election. At this point, we haven't got all the costs in because we still have one more to go, but it's looking right now, it actually will cost us more than the $30,000. So we are going to have to cut a staff member from the school district in the next year in order to pay for this election, the four elections that happened this year. So again, I guess Covey Heights is asking for your support to pass the file in front of you. And in addition to the cost and voter confusion in the community, we're asking that school boards who have board member resignations during the last 2 years of their term to be able to have the option of appointing those terms instead of going to a special election.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for Mr. Holmgren? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Hager, James Hager. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Howe, members of the committee. My name is James Hager. I'm here with Education Minnesota, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. We do have a few concerns we want to share about the bill. While we understand, respect, and share the concerns around the money and time that goes into the special elections, we are concerned that the bill is written, even with the A2 amendment, does limit really the public's voice in this process. Under the bill, you could have a school board member, even multiple school board members, as in the case of Columbia Heights, appointed for up to 2 years, which in the case of Columbia Heights would be 33% of their board appointed for up to 2 years. This would mean that the existing majority of the board, rather than the voters, would be choosing the people who make our local education policies and oversee district budgets. There's a reason we have school board elections in the first place, and that public oversight and accountability that comes with those elections is important. Many districts have budgets in the tens and even hundreds of millions of dollars, and we're concerned that the bill as written allows for too many appointees to serve for too long without the public's input. As the bill moves forward, we would encourage Representative Howe to continue to look for ways, like the A3 and A4 amendments would have, to add more of the public's voice into the process. And with that, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Hager? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else? Yes, Mr. Hillier. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Thank you, Government Operations Election Policy Committee and Chair and members for this opportunity to speak today on 3123. Name is Rick Keller, and officially represent the Twice Exceptional and Print Disabled. I don't know, I'm going to speak, frankly, as an individual that goes to school board meetings. I do regularly. I do petition through the school board. They're not always effective, but they do get back to me occasionally. I think it's relevant that the early secondary success act 2015, which used to be No Child Left Behind, requires that it's essential that parents are engaged in the process. It's my understanding last few years we've given more governance to school boards regarding levies. I would think at this bill I would reject the bill. However, the 4A does supplement it. However, you voted that down. I think it's relevant that individuals have a time to express their views to the public. When they campaign, I suggest perhaps moving a requirement into the bill or into the law, frankly, that when school board members decide to get out, they require early notice so we don't get in timeline crunches as it relates to November, perhaps. Everybody needs notice. I don't think the 30-day notice is enough, frankly. Again, I've testified numerous times in Okehennepin. You can go online and review those if you choose to. However, I believe it's only 4-5% that review the streaming videos that don't have closed captioning. So I guess they're not including that audience. They're not required to regarding the FCC. Again, I think we need to provide more engagement for the public to weigh in about how policies are developed, how referendums are put on their taxes. They need to vote on this. They need to vote for people to know what ideology, what kind of thinking they have regarding how they're going to move on the school board regarding certain concerns and how receptive they are to the public. Again, I oppose this bill 2123. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Any questions for this testifier, Mr. Heller? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, Madam Chair. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a comment, and that is that while this may fix some problems in the current law, in current law is authority for the school board to actually remove members with a vote of the board. And that has not been fixed, I don't believe. And it just seems like when you add that all up, you know, you have an opportunity that is, there's way too much opportunity for the public not to be involved. So it seems like it would be worthy of addressing a recall of some sort rather than a vote of the board just simply being the way to eliminate somebody.
Good comment. Thank you. Thank you. Any other? Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Runbeck, I agree with you. I believe that process of a few members removing without any reason in statute another board member would probably be deemed unconstitutional at some point if it was taken off the chain. So I think that it would be wise in us to some point take care of that. I was hoping that would be taken care of in this session also, but another day, maybe we can do that together. Thank you.
Thank you. I smell a bill coming forthwith. Representative Howe, your bill, as amended, House File 3123, is laid over. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, committee.
Next, we will take up House File 2959, Representative McNamara. Where's this going? Welcome to the committee, Chair McNamara. I will go ahead and move that House File 2959 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. With that, Mr. Chair, we welcome you to the committee. You can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think for the sake of time, I'll have both of the testifiers introduce themselves and explain the bill about this offering an alternative practice, I think, that would be a good thing for folks that vote absentee. So I'll let them explain who they are and the common sense of the bill. And
excellent.
We can have some discussion. I believe, Mr. Chair, it's going to be laid over.
Perfect. Welcome to the committee, both of you. Just introduce yourself for the record, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Cindy Geis, and I am the current County Auditor Treasurer for Scott County. I'm also the Division Director for the Property and Customer Services Division, which oversees about 7 different departments. I'm here today just to talk to you a little bit about how this bill came to be. About a year ago, there's a group of counties, maybe about a handful. We got together and we started talking about this upcoming election for this year, and we were trying to talk about how are we going to manage the process? And by that I meant we know that this is the first election that where no excuse absentee voting was going to be probably used in full force. And with that, we are understanding a huge uptick in the number of absentees that were going to be coming our way. Some of the challenges that we currently have for the in-person is the spacing. And really, it's that last week where everything breaks loose and people are rushing to the county. In Scott County, we're the only office where we do all the absentees. So if people want to vote by absentee, they got to come and see us. With that, we don't have the spacing to try to manage the amount of people that we're anticipating coming through our doors. And with that, we're trying to think about ways that we could move these people that come to our county in that last week a little bit quicker in and out. But still understanding the integrity of the elections process and trying to ensure that process is held to its utmost, because ultimately nobody wants the elections process to be called out on the carpet saying that we did something wrong. So we got together and we started talking about how we were going to, what can we do to really make sure that that voter experience is enhanced, but yet the elections process, the integrity of it is held to its utmost. So with that, we thought about what if all of the assurances of the identity, people come to the county, they still fill out an application, we go into SVRS, we see their identity, we know they are who they say they are before they get a ballot. So that first process continues just as it has in the past. The difference would be they have to stand in line, they have to fill out their application to receive an absentee. They stand in line, the election judges do all their authentication, they validate the voter, they give them the ballot and the envelopes that go with it. That voter takes that ballot, they go to their voting booth and they do their voting process. Then they have to go stand back in that same line with everybody else who's trying to get their ballot and have their ballot, their envelope witnessed. When they get their ballot, they have to take it and they have to fold it multiple ways, put it inside of an orange envelope, security envelope, then they put it inside of a white envelope. The top of that is all filled in with the voters, who they are, their identification number, whether it be Social Security number or a driver's license. Then they come back up to the election judge who already validated they are who they say they are, and they sign that white envelope, and the vote, and then the election judge signs the white envelope as well. What we're saying is, once you do your voting, we know you are who you say you are because we've already saw everything that we needed to identify you. After you're done casting your ballot, go right to the tabulator and put it in the tabulator. Now, the reason that we're saying this last 7 days is because as they're standing in line, people like me and my staff are coming into the absentee election room, and where they're putting their ballots, they're seeing us dump them all out into a bin or some type of a device that we're going to carry them off into a different room. And on that very same day, after ballot board, we're going to open those up and we're going to put them through the tabulator. And the look on the people's faces when they see that their ballots are being carted out of that room. And of course, we open these ballots in some place that's visual, and they're seeing us open the ballots and put them in the tabulator. They're like, what the heck? What are you doing with my ballot? You know, are you sure you're going to count my ballot? So we are trying to make sure that that process, that voter experience, they know that their vote, when it goes into that tabulator, is counted. Now, the other thing that we are also trying to ensure is the voter's intent. And that in the time period before that last 7 days, any voter can come back and they can request their ballot back. And so then we mark it and the system is rejected and they can go to the polls or they can re-vote, whatever they want to do. But in that last 7 days, they can't. Because guess what? We're approving them and we're putting it right into the tabulator and that ship has sailed. So if they said, oh my gosh, I did something wrong, it's too late. And in this process, once they put it into the tabulator and it's actually counted, that ship has also sailed. But if they crossed over or if they voted too many in a specific race, that voter would have that shown to them on the screens to say, hey, guess what? You crossed over and your vote's not even going to count. They can spoil their ballot at that time and they can go through the process again right at that same time before it's counted. So we're just giving them some assurances that their vote is counted. We're allowing them to see that if there's an error on their ballot, they can have it fixed. And it's only in those last 7 days that we're actually opening them and putting them in the tabulator anyway. So with that, Mr. Chair or members, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Geis. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Jennifer Wagenius, Director of Property Records and Taxpayer Services at Washington County. Cindy did a great job explaining the process. I'm just going to add a few more talking points here. The rules that are existing in statute should serve people, and the in-person absentee voter, the rules do serve people. The rules requiring them to put the ballot into two different envelopes do serve people until that last 7 days before the election, when they don't. At that point of the election cycle, like Cindy indicated, the voter may not cast a new ballot, and the absentee ballot board is opening the envelopes and running the ballots through the tabulator. Again, that language only that we're asking for today only allows this to occur during that last 7 days. For Washington County, based on the historical data that we've looked at and the changes to the in-person absentee, about 60% of our in-person voters come to the county that last week before the election. So this change impacts 60% of the in-person voters, and for us, we're expecting that to be about 10,000 people. So 10,000 people who have an opportunity to spoil their ballot and get a new ballot if they've made an error. 20,000 envelopes that don't need to be touched by the county, opened twice. 10,000 ballots that don't need to be flattened and run through the tabulator by county staff. That makes a big difference. Allowing them to do this, feed the ballot through the machine themselves, saves them time and money and saves us time and money. They don't have to stand in line twice. There are concerns about space, as Cindy indicated. The county, at Washington County, we've made a substantial investment in services for absentee voters for the 2016 election. The board's allocated resource for additional staff. We've purchased additional equipment and reconfigured some of our service spaces to allow these voters to get in and out. But even with all of those changes, we need your help and we need this extra tool in our toolbox this year to deal with the voters that will be coming in that last week before the election in 2016.
Thank you very much. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was answered.
Perfect. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say this is a great idea, and you did a wonderful job explaining it, all the envelope moving around and stuff, and then just taking it off and putting it in for them. This is a wonderful idea, and I wholeheartedly support it.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Members, any other questions or discussion to this bill? Seeing none, Representative McNamara, do you have any final comments or words before we lay it over for possible inclusion?
Thanks for the time for the hearing, and I do think it's a great idea, a common sense thing that would allow a more efficient and transparent system. And it's important for folks to realize that when they do come in and vote absentee, they need to actually show who they are by presenting an ID, and that who, and oftentimes these are senior citizens, and when they look at it, because they may be concerned on election day, be in November, if the weather's bad, whatever. I've heard from them, and they say, why do I, you know, fill the envelopes out, do all that, stand in line again, when I understand that the person I gave it to is going to cart it off into another room and then put it into the machine. And then it's important that folks realize this would allow someone that by accident has overvoted, say, in a school board election. Maybe there's a school board election and you can vote for up to three. By accident, they voted for four. Their ballot would get rejected and they would have an opportunity to resubmit it. So that's an important thing, I think. It's just, I think, real good transparency and good government.
Thank you, Representative McNamara, and thank you to the testifiers. With that, we will lay over House File 2959 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Next up, we will do the Secretary of State technical bill, House File 2688.
Chairman Sanders, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will move House File 2688 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And members, just so you know, this will be the House File for the omnibus bill that we will build. With that, members, I have Ms. Strother here from the Secretary of State's office. This is the Secretary of State's technical bill, and I appreciate Representative Nelson's co-authorship and looking forward to working with him as we build the omnibus bill.
Ms. Strother, if you'd state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Julie Strother with the Office of the Secretary of State. I will go through this very quickly, but I'm happy to answer questions on any provisions after I've gone through. Sections 1 and 18, I'll go through by section, prevents a school district election from being held on the date of a March township election. Sections 2, 11, and 12 remove the requirement that certain documents be sent by certified mail. Section 3 allows an absentee ballot application from a military or overseas voter to be extended through the next general election. Right now, they go through the calendar year, and we got about 55 this December. They obviously intended that to be for the 2016 November election, and this would just allow that to then go through the general election. Section 4 closes a loophole in Minnesota law that would allow someone to file a nominating petition for a presidential candidate who's also a major party presidential candidate. Sections 5, 8, 10, and 16 are all conforming changes to reflect previous changes in state law. Section 6 allows a soil and water commissioner district to be modified if municipal boundaries are also modified. Section 7 removes the prescription in state law requiring and specifying the height, depth, and width of voting booths. Section 9 is a clarifying change to address reported confusion about who a petition in a school district or city election must be delivered to. Sections 13 and 15 clarify ballot placement and office identification on a ballot when more than one school board or city council member is up for election for a full term. Section 14 addresses a conflict in current statute regarding the time for cancellation of an election, and it reconciles the two dates with the standard cancellation time period. Section 17 requires uniformity in affidavits of candidacy. This is similar to a change we made in 2014, making uniform city election affidavits of candidacy. And Section 19 is a change that incorporates the notice of contest procedures already established in 204D.27. With that, I'm happy to answer questions on any of the specific provisions in the bill.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Maury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering on the nominating petition, and I didn't read the other statutes. So can somebody file a nominating petition for a presidential primary, and that one, let's say, this year we had a president, let's say we had a presidential primary, and you had whoever was on it. And then I got a nomination petition for Mike Nelson and got it there. Would his name then appear on the presidential primary if I got enough signatures?
Ms. Strother.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative, Section 4 of the bill deals with the current process for a nominating petition for a presidential candidate only on the general election ballot. Right now, we got a question about from a national organization about whether, for example, if you thought back 2 years ago, if Barack Obama was the major party candidate, which is a different process for getting on the general election ballot, there's a question about whether or not someone could say, like, put his name up as a Green Party candidate or another third party candidate on the ballot so his name would appear twice. And our lawyers looked at it and thought that that was a legitimate reading of our current state law, though not the intent. So this would close that loophole, essentially saying if the person is already a major party candidate on the ballot, you can't also nominate them as a minor or third party candidate. How that would relate to the presidential primary legislation that is currently in process, I think the nominating petition for the general, it doesn't change how the nominating petition for the general November election works, and this only deals with the nominating petition to get a minor or third party candidate on the November general ballot, if that answers your question.
Representative Maury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What would happen, can somebody have a nominating petition? I think I understand what you're saying, this language is, and can somebody under the presidential primary have a nominating petition and put a name on the ballot that way?
Ms. Strother.
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding of the presidential primary language that came before this committee is that it mirrors the current process to get on the straw poll ballot with the parties, and that it doesn't go through a nominating petition, but it goes through the party process to get on the ballot. So this language wouldn't allow a nominating petition to be used to get someone on the presidential primary ballot if that legislation were to pass.
And Mr. Gehring? to that point?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, the language that's in the current presidential primary bill allows the parties, as Mr. Strother said, to choose the names of people that appear on the ballot and on behalf of that primary, so there wouldn't be a petition process. It'd be up to the major party chairs to decide who their candidates are on the ballot, and there wouldn't be a presidential primary under the current language for minor party candidates or other independent candidates. It would just be for the two major parties, so this conflict wouldn't exist under the bill that is proposed right now.
Representative Mullery?
No.
Okay. Any other member questions? No. Chairman Sanders?
No, laid over.
No. Okay, very good. As was previously stated, this bill will be laid over. Now we'd like to call Representative Peterson. We're ready to hear your bill. There she is.
Okay, with that, welcome to the committee, Representative Peterson, and we'll go ahead and move House File 2497 to the General Register.
Thank you, Chair Sanders, and I do have treats because I know it's going to be a long day here today, and I have choices of healthy or not as healthy. So whatever works for you, and I don't know if you have pages or if you would like me to just pass it around and you guys can pass it around yourself.
Yeah, we're self-sufficient here, Representative Peterson.
Right.
You can just throw it on a table and we'll figure it out. Yeah. Representative Albright will figure it out for us, I'm sure.
All right, thank you. And Mr. Chair, I believe we do have one oral amendment at the request of the county that we'd like to also address as well.
Okay, so we have we need to move the DE3, and that's your author's amendment, Representative Peterson.
Thank you.
I'll move the DE3. Members, any discussion to put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE3, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. And Representative Peterson, you have an oral amendment, which will be the A2, and it changes the effective date to July 1st, 2016, is that correct, Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The current effective date in the delete all is immediate, and this changes it to July 1st.
Okay, with that, members, any discussion to the oral amendment to put the bill to shape the author wishes?
Chair, where was that oral amendment?
It's not handed out, it's an oral amendment.
Representative Nelson, it's to the DE3. It changes the effective date, which is on page 5 and page 7. And we'll just leave the instructions that anywhere the effective date is, it should be changed to July 1st, 2016. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Peterson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You may be aware that there is a silver tsunami coming our way. In fact, by 2020, the people over the age of 65 will outnumber our K-12 children that are enrolled in school. So this is a concern, and for that reason, the Department of Human Services decided to try some innovative grants, and this is a result of that work. But we also wanted to make sure that we had options for families that was affordable. So that's what started what is called a drop home. And drop homes are for family members to be able to take care of their loved ones. And a lot of times when they find out that their parents or somebody else that's a relative needs to have some help, they do not have a lot of time to address that issue. And so this process helps cities and counties develop a process that is palatable and upfront, but also really eliminates a lot of the long process that typically goes with city hearings and things of that nature, which are also very important. At the State Fair, these gentlemen, who are very innovative entrepreneurs, presented their drop home at the State Fair, and there were 250 people who are interested in
using their services where you can rent this home or you can purchase one. And they found that once they got to the city process that it basically did not work. In fact, cities were confused. They wanted to make a manufactured home, which it's not. They wanted to make it a recreational vehicle, which it is not. It comes in on a trailer and is dropped, you know, in the backyard, and you hook up the hose. It's an insulated hose, and you plug it in. So it's relatively easy. The average stay for these temporary dwellings are for 44 days. So it really is to try to fill a gap on transitional housing before you can find options for these people. And also something that's affordable. It's only $1,250 a month. Versus if you look at assisted living or other options like that, it's $3,000 to $5,000 a month. So before we start putting people in peril by using all their life savings just at their end of life, this is an option for families to take care of their loved ones at home and give them some dignity. And I'll just walk you very quickly through the bill. The first, it's basically called a temporary conditional use permit for cities and counties. There have been some people who don't necessarily like the conditional use permit because it relates to a lot of other conditional use permits, so we could change the name to a temporary dwelling permit. So I'll let you think about that, and we can certainly consider that wording change if that helps. It requires the primary caregiver to give a certificate of need. So there has to be some medical professional involved in making sure that there actually is a need for this service. And the owners of the property have to sign the permit. So if you're renting or if you own the home, everyone is informed. In fact, also you need proof of the provider network. You needed an executed contract for septic services and that they're accessible. You need to notice all the adjacent neighbors. You need to include a site map so that you'll have an aerial shot of where the house is, where this will be placed, and so the city has that included as well. They must be located on the home property, and they must comply with setback requirements. It's one person per one unit. It comes with a $100 fee because, remember, we're trying to make this affordable. And it's for only 6 months. However, it may be renewed, and then it could go through the regular city process that cities are more accustomed to. Inspections are allowed. They may revoke if violations occur, and they must be removed within 60 days. The utilities is just like I said, a simple hot tub connection. So, you know, after the temporary dwelling is gone, here comes the spa. So it's a win-win for everybody. And then also cities and counties have 15 days to either accept or deny the permit. And then on top of that, cities also have the option to opt out completely. But I will add, members, that before cities and counties decide to just opt out before we even try it, I do encourage them to actually get one permit and see how it goes before they just decide, I guess it just doesn't work because we're not going to try anything new. And I do have a couple testifiers today. We are our testifier who actually tried to put a home in her home to take care of her mother could not be here today because she actually has to take care of her mother. So, but I will pass it on to my testifiers if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your brief testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Lewisell, and I'd just like to say thanks to everyone involved who we've met with, those who we haven't met with. Hello, I guess. I'll pass it up to Jesse to introduce himself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. My name is Jesse Lamy. My business partner, John, we are the co-founders of Next Door Housing. Thank you.
If I could, Mr. Chair, Anita Burke is the individual who testified with us in the long-term care committee. She could not be here today due to a medically scheduled meeting with her mother. She asked in lieu of her absence us to read her letter to you. In the interest of time, I'm going to read fast. Dear members of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee, my name is Anita Burke and I reside in Apple Valley. I encourage you to pass HF 2497 regarding temporary family health care dwellings. My home sits on a little less than half an acre. I am the daughter of Doris Hunt, on whose behalf I write to you today. My mother is 80 years old, and her health has been failing for the last year. After being hospitalized, then put into rehab or nursing home care several times in the last 4 years, she decided in December of 2015 to be admitted into hospice care. She is currently living in an assisted living facility in Eagan. Her rent for a studio apartment is $3,170 a month, and her care services run an additional $5,000 a month since December. Given that her pension and Social Security income comes to just under $2,900 a month, she is quickly running out of funds. She has only 2 or 3 months of reserves before her funds will be gone. Over the last couple of years, I've tried to find more affordable housing for her, but have been unable to find an affordable alternative that would meet her current needs. However, this past summer, I saw a video for temporary family health care dwellings through Nextdoor Housing and thought that at some point, this might be an option worth looking into. Once my mother entered hospice care, I decided to give them a call and see if the service would be a viable option for my family. I contacted them, and they called the city of Apple Valley to see if this would be an option for my mom and I. I knew that it would probably be a long shot to get approval, but thought it was worth a shot. Even though I knew it might not work, I was still disappointed to hear that the city did not think they would be able to permit me to utilize this service. If I could move my mother into my home, I would. However, my home does not have a handicap accessible bathroom or main floor facility. I do not have a spare bedroom since my 8 children still live at home. I do not work outside the home and would be able to provide for my mother's needs. Her pension would more than cover the cost of renting a unit like this and still leave funds for me to hire aides to be with my mother when I am unavailable. I am able and willing to make the sacrifices necessary to care for her on a daily basis. My only problem is that there's literally no room in my home to do so, and my husband and I cannot afford to put an addition onto our house. In retrospect, Nextdoor Housing would have been a wonderful option for my family 3 times in the past. Once, my father, who lived outside of Bemidji, unexpectedly had heart surgery in Minneapolis. The second time was when my father had a stroke. Both times, moving him temporarily onto my property would have benefited him and put my family at ease, knowing that he was able to be looked after instead of being alone in a cabin 10 miles out of town, 4.5 hours from family. The third time was when my mother, who resided in Florida at the time, had heart surgery here in Minnesota 9 years ago. After her surgery and rehab at a transitional care facility here in Minnesota, she rushed back to Florida, where there was no family to help her because she wanted a little privacy and did not want to inconvenience us. An option such as this would afford both my father and mother the privacy and handicap accessible facilities they needed while still enabling them to recover with the help of us, their family. All three of these situations were times of crisis where there was no time to build additions, remodel bathrooms, or wait weeks to hopefully get permits from a city to allow for temporary housing so that appropriate care could be given.
Sir, there are many sir, I'm going to cut you off there. We have this letter in our packet. Oh, so we have like 4 or 5 more paragraphs to go. I appreciate that. I don't want to throw you off your game, and we appreciate the testimony from Ms. Burke, but members, it is in your packets. You certainly can feel free to summarize the rest or provide some comments, but we've got a lot of left on the agenda. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to briefly summarize. John and I have been working for 2 years to try to help people in a desperate need. And unfortunately, we have not had a lot of success, as is evident from Anita's story. We've been working hard, and despite our best efforts, we can't make this work with the current options out there. We understand that cities have existing permits, which work very well for a 3 to 5 year term. If you're looking at building a manufactured home, maybe it's a detached mother-in-law apartment, if you will. Unfortunately, that's failing these people. All in all, this bill does 2 things. It provides a tool for the cities to help their residents in need, an option to quickly respond to them and allow them to stay part of their community and stay with their family. The second thing it does is provide families time. Time to recover, time to heal, and time to plan for their future rather than make a hasty decision. Whether that means waiting out a wait list for a local bed or going through the existing process to have a more permanent long-term solution on their property. All in all, I believe that families should be applauded for taking the step and having the willingness to care for their loved ones rather than discouraged from doing so. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have a few folks also on the list to testify. Why don't you guys hang around, because I'm sure there'll be some questions for you. We have Gene Christoffels and Craig Johnson. I have those individuals on the list. come on down. Go ahead, introduce yourself for the record, and we look forward to your brief testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I do have copies of my testimony here if you would like to have that distributed. My name is Jean Christoffels. I am the Maury County Zoning Administrator from Southwest Minnesota. I currently serve as a legislative chair for the Association of Minnesota, for the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators, which is an affiliate of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and is also a voice for county planning and zoning staff across the state. On behalf of our association, I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to comment on House File 2497. We met with the drop home company that has been pushing for House File 2497, and while we support their idea and concept for these temporary home family health care dwellings, we have many concerns with this bill as written and the increased demands and burdens that would be placed on local governments. Some of Minnesota's 87 counties, such as McLeod, Stearns, Douglas, Dodge, and Polk, already have the mechanisms in place for permitting these temporary family health care dwellings through their local ordinance via a conditional use permit or an interim use permit. As proposed, this bill appears to circumvent the already existing process afforded counties in Minnesota Statute 394 by creating a new type of permit and process that is specific to this one particular use. Creation of a new permit type and process will add confusion to not only local government officials, but also to your constituents when they seek permits for projects. Some counties with current ordinance language for these dwellings are permitting them as conditional use permits or as an interim use permit, which according to statute requires a public hearing. A public hearing affords the neighbors an opportunity to comment on the proposed use, creating a sense of government transparency and better communication between neighbors. As zoning administrators, we know the constituents in our counties and believe a public hearing for these temporary family health care dwellings would be the most appropriate way to process them to truly vet any problems that may arise and to keep everything transparent. Also, if these dwellings were permitted as a conditional use or an interim use, there is no need to create a new type of permit, which is what the current language of the bill proposes to do. On lines 4.23 to 4.32 of House File 2497, the bill identifies Minnesota Statute 15.99, which is the law that requires local units of government to make decisions on zoning requests within 60 days. However, this bill would require a zoning decision on these temporary family health care dwellings to be made within 15 days, which would not only add unnecessary confusion to zoning laws and processes for citizens, but it would also create an immense amount of pressure on county permitting staff to circumvent standard practices in order to accommodate the provisions of this bill. One final note, the effective date identified in this bill and now as amended in this bill would place an undue hardship on the local units of government to not only become educated on a new permit and process, but also because all 87 counties would be required to amend local ordinances to stay in compliance if this bill becomes law. By statute, amending ordinances takes time and requires a public hearing or hearings to afford the public an opportunity to comment on the changes. It would be more realistic to have an effective date of January 1, 2017, or even 1 year from final enactment, so that county staff have time to prepare for a whole new permitting process. Mr. Chair and members, we understand and believe there is a need to allow these temporary family health care dwellings and are not trying to prohibit them. On the contrary, we are simply asking of the permitting to ensure all constituents within our respective jurisdictions are treated fairly and to utilize already existing enabling law that local government and constituents are familiar with. Our association believes House File 2497 would create undue, costly administrative burdens on counties through the creation of a new permitting process for one specific use, increased monitoring and enforcement actions, and ordinance amendments. And it is for these reasons that the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators oppose House File 2497. I want to thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and members, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Ms. Christoffels. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to start by thanking the author, Representative Peterson, and the advocates for this bill. We have met very many times with them over the past couple of months as we've worked on this, which is an advantage that some of the other folks are just starting to do some of those meetings with them. So we have reached a slightly different point in our discussions. The delete all amendment that you approved today, in particular with the change to enactment date, is a good good step forward in our opinion. It actually addresses a number of issues that were raised in the last hearing. I just want to start by clarifying that, you know, cities, counties, and townships are statutorily obligated to handle issues of public health, safety, and welfare for the jurisdictions they are elected to represent. And that's where this issue falls, is how do we make sure that we are able to do those? And the way that we do that is by having to balance the needs and the rights and the uses between property owners who live next to each other and may not share the same needs as each other. So it gets to be very difficult anytime you're talking about who has the right to do what, when, and where. With that in mind, we have seen a number of changes made that we think are good in this version of the delete all amendment. You also should have a letter that was sent in today by the city of Burnsville as an example of the kind of feedback we are getting since we sent this information out last night when we saw the amendment posted. We will continue to forward information to the author and to others involved in this as we get it, but you can see the level of difficulty this brings as people decide how is it that we can enforce this type of statute. In particular, small things matter a lot when you're talking about permitting decisions because litigation happens with permitting decisions. So any time that it looks like you're giving vagueness and general ability, you also are risking that a decision can be challenged because it was not made for cause. So for instance, where it says a temporary permit is 6 months and that an additional 6 months is the extension, that's great. That defines a temporary window. But the language right now that, you know, we're happy to work with the author on in the future says, or longer if everyone agrees to it. And now we would have to explain why didn't we agree to longer. And we would have to have a cause for not agreeing to longer. And really, if you're defining this as a temporary use, having the site there for a year is probably about as long as temporary really is in terms of a land use for a residency on a property. We do have continuing issues, as you see in the letter, related to enforcement, related to timing, and relating to terminology. We do feel it would be helpful. There's a lot of confusion in the feedback we're getting about using the term temporary conditional use. Conditional use is a very specific process, a permitting process, and this isn't using that process. So we think using a different term there would eliminate some of that confusion. We will work on our other concerns and technical corrections as we spot them with the author and the advocates. We very much appreciate the time they've put into this and the time the committee is giving to the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick yes or no from both testifiers to the question. Are you working on model legislation within your organizations for your member cities and member counties to deal with this type of issue?
Ms. Christoffels.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, not at this time.
Mr. Chair, no, we're not working on model legislation. We would work on a model ordinance or something of that nature, mm-hmm. if there was a need for that, if the law moves forward, but not at this time.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an excellent idea whose time has come, and we have to find a way to make it work. And that's what I'm encouraging here. There seems to be a continuous problem, this and that and the other thing, and so this idea is hitting a bureaucratic nightmare. But we have to find a way to make it work. I would encourage a supportive approach. If there needs to be a model ordinance so that you can deal with some of these at the ordinance level, make a model ordinance for the cities or counties to use. Find a way to make this work. Instead of saying, well, this conflicts with this and that and the other thing, it's a new day. And this is a need that we will have more and more. It is just a fact.
It's an excellent suggestion. It's an excellent opportunity for us all. I'm just saying, make it work.
Thank you, Representative Lane. This time I want to bring down Mr. Bruner from with Modular Homes and get some of their issues on the record so that we fully understand this issue and, as Representative Lane said, maybe find a way to make this all work. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Bruner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. And we did visit briefly with the author ahead of the hearing about a concern we have that specifically relates to the way the bill is drafted would preclude the use of modular homes as a temporary health care dwelling. A modular home is built to the state building code. It receives an inspection label called an IBC label, which is administered through the Department of Labor and Industry. Under current statute, you could use a modular home as a temporary health care dwelling if that's what its designated purpose was, if you went before a city council. However, what the bill does is defines that a temporary health care dwelling needs to comply with an ANSI code, or essentially what it is a seal from the National RV Association that says that the home complies with the standards for an RV. So our concern is that the bill, perhaps unintentionally, will preclude modular homes from being used as a temporary health care dwelling, which they can currently be used for.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner, for your testimony.
And I would perhaps just make one additional point, Mr. Chairman. It's our understanding that the standard that's being referenced in the bill, that these units will be constructed to, no longer exists. It's essentially been replaced by an NFPA standard or a 2009 ANSI standard. So going forward, if there's another amendment, perhaps that should be corrected. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Very valid points. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I think that, Representative Lane, thank you so much for your comments. I really appreciate them. And I think it highlights some of the concerns that we've had. I want to thank the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties for working with us for the past several months on this bill, because we did want to try to craft something that would work and probably give cities and counties an opportunity to say, you know what, this I think addresses most of your concerns, and we do not want to add any more burdens on the cities and counties. We just want to have a process. They know it's happening. Quite frankly, if there is a concern, it could be happening right now. I mean, so there's already the argument about enforcement at this point. But I don't know if you have any other. No? Okay.
Well, we'll go to, we have a few member questions quickly before we wrap things up on this bill. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, I like the bill. It seems like you're working with the League of Minnesota Cities, the counties. Are you working with the townships as well? Have you spoken with the townships? League? I see Mr. Sulem is here.
No, we're here.
Okay. So we're going to attain a little bit of, I can't say peace in the valley, but I did anyway. And would encourage you just to tighten this up. You know, from a former mayor's perspective, there's some things that raise questions in my mind. Don't want to get in the way of city's ability to do their jobs. But I really do like this.
Thank you.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair Sanders. I have just a few quick questions, some technical for the author and some for the gentleman here. So first, real quickly, Mr. Lucella and Lamere? I'm sorry. Yeah. I wrote them down. Now I can't read my own writing.
Mr. Chair, Lucella and Lammy.
Lammy. Okay, thank you. On the lines 3.3 to 3.4 and 5.29 to 5.30 regarding electrical utilities, what is the amperage, and is there a circuit breaker?
Mr. Chair. Representative, we are wired, as was mentioned, ANSI code 119.2, the identical counterpart, which was noted as 1192 NFPA, and that regulates basically everything, how they're wired up. 30 to 50 amperage is how it works, the standard plug-in, as Representative Peterson mentioned. Same thing you'd have installed on your house if you got a hot tub. Thank you.
Representative Joaquin.
Okay, so it's I was more worried about the connection between the unit and the house, so it's something that fire marshals look at and are okay with?
Mr. Lamy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The hookups, yes, are standard. It's a licensed and licensed electrician has to do all the installations, of course. All cables that are used for the connections, et cetera, are all approved and meet all OSHA standards, if you will. Thank you.
Representative Joaquin.
Chair Sanders, maybe this one's for Representative Peterson. Part of that language also says, or comparable means. Would that mean a generator?
It's Mr. Lamy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We left that language a little bit vague, and that was part of a conversation with the League of Cities that they wanted someone to interpret where if a city wanted something done a certain way, they had the flexibility to do so within the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Joaquin.
Chair Sanders, thank you. I was just a little worried because I know if it was a generator, a lot of us have visited the food trucks, you know how loud they can be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of our 50-foot lots in Hopkins, and that could be a little disturbing to the neighbors. Mm-hmm. And then one other quick question for Representative Peterson. I appreciate the opt-out on Section 9 that's in the delete all. How does that work with the language on 3.16?
Representative Peterson.
Okay, so Mr. Chair and Representative Joaquin, basically cities can opt out and say we're not going to follow these rules whatsoever, and so they can do their own thing or they can continue with their status quo. Versus 3.16 is basically saying that in order to transport this, they would be using a one-ton pickup truck versus a crane, for example, that would typically be used with modular homes or something of that sort. We wanted to stay away from anything that looked like manufactured housing because just as you have heard, where you don't want to get into laws of other areas, and I do think that we really want to change that terminology to the temporary dwelling unit, dwelling permit, just to clarify that we don't get caught up in the existing laws for conditional use permits and interim permits.
Representative Joaquin.
Chair Sanders, sorry, I'm a little confused because I'm looking at the delete all and it's actually talking about prohibited under any other local ordinances. So that's where the city can't prohibit it, but then in Section 9 we're doing opt-out. So I'm just wondering how those two would work together.
Representative Peterson.
Well, in this case, we don't want them to say no before they have that opt-out, but we're giving cities an opt-out because this was really to accommodate the cities and counties, to be honest with you. This is a conversation on what do you have rights on your own personal property versus what the city should be dictating what you do. And to me, if you can actually fit in this particular model, you have to have enough room. You have to have someone who's willing to take care of this family member, by the way. You have to be able to get it into your property. It's not going to probably work in a 50-foot lot, for example, just because of there will be no place to put it. So there's a lot of locations that this simply will not work. Or they live on a hill and there's no flat land for people to put it on. So it's really trying to just say, you know what, if all the stars align perfectly, we want to have a process that's quick and not have to go through, you know, several hearing process, which we all know takes several weeks. And by then, the whole need is gone. So that's the purpose behind the bill, if that makes sense. And maybe, do you want to comment?
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Joaquin, the sentence that you're referring to in the delete all that says that the dwelling that's meeting the requirements of the section can't be prohibited under other local ordinance relating to
regulating accessory uses and RV parking or storage. That actually was added in response to the concern that if you turn to page 4.6 to 4.8, the paragraph E says that unless otherwise provided, the dwelling has to comply with all other laws, local ordinances, and requirements. And there are communities that prohibit parking RVs. And since this is similar to, or essentially an RV, that was the concern that if it's an RV that meets the requirements of this section, you can't use the RV no parking ordinance to prohibit it. So that was what was intended by that sentence. The opt-out is you're either in or you're out. But that's the explanation of what that's intended to cover.
Representative Joaquim.
Chair Sanders and Tyson, thank you. That's why I was wondering. So it would also mean on 3.16, if there was ordinances in town about RV parking, like having to have it screened, you wouldn't have to meet those requirements, basically, is what it's saying. So you don't have to screen it. You don't have to. Okay, thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the question I have, reading the bill, and it's not in the amendment, in the bill it talks about limited to one occupant who is mentally or physically impaired, and there's other language here talking about a person, and I just wanted, what I'm asking for is, I friends of my father's, the wife, I think it was, had Alzheimer's when her husband had physical issues where they both had to go in a nursing home, and like reading the original bill, they wouldn't have been able to put one of these up on one of their son's houses deal with this, because there'd be more than one occupant there. So did that get removed for that reason? And I guess the other side of that is, how many people could you stuff into this if there's no limit? I mean, some of the houses, we're used to bigger homes and bigger spaces, but some houses are, when you look at them later on in life, they're really tiny that, people have many, many kids and stuff them into a one-bedroom or two-bedroom house. So, I guess that's the question I have right now. It's not in the, I don't see it in the amendment, but in the bill it says only limited to one occupant.
Mm-hmm. Representative Peterson.
Chair Sanders, Representative Nelson. So 4.4 to 4.5, it says it's limited to one occupant who is identified in the application, because remember they have to get the doctor's approval. And one temporary health care dwelling unit is allowed on the lot. So in that case, two people could not qualify.
Representative Nelson.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the situations I laid out where a spouse, husband and wife, both need to go, or all of a sudden go into a nursing home facility, they wouldn't be able to utilize this because they're only one occupant. And I guess I'm just asking that because it might be something, in a case like that, it might be something that you want to look at or not. But like I said, this couple was, again, when the one passed away, the other one left within a week of the other one. Yeah. Like I said, one had Alzheimer's, the other one ended up with health conditions that could no longer take care of the other, and they both ended up having to go to a nursing home facility at once. And mm-hmm. So in this case, they would not be able to use this option.
Sounds like something to think over. Final member question, Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Peterson, for bringing forward this bill. I think, and thank you for all the work that you have done and you are doing with local units of government to make it workable for everybody. I think this does fill a need. And I'm sorry, I had to step out for a minute, so if this question is redundant, I apologize. But I just noticed, and maybe this is for your testifiers, but that North Carolina, Virginia, New York have already passed these laws, and so I'm just wondering, how long have the laws been in effect? How have they worked out? How much do we have any idea of the numbers of people that have utilized this? And was there some modeling done on the legislation from those states?
Very briefly, Mr. Lewiso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This passed in North Carolina in 2014, I believe, similar years or a year or two prior in the other two states. The models were different. They were much more permanent. Year-long permits, unlimited year-long renewals. In that instance, it is working in the way it's intended to work. Obviously, that solution isn't something that the cities of Minnesota are necessarily interested in taking on that load right now. So in this instance, we're talking about a little bit different of a market in the fact that we can quickly and succinctly implement one of these homes and prevent someone from needing a nursing home or other type of transitional establishment. It's been working well, but the permitting and the process of the longer placements are, it's a much more expensive ordeal. You've got to lay slabs, you've got to do city water, sewer, stuff like that. But they are seeing a positive benefit there, of course. Everyone likes having their family closer to home when they want to have them closer to home.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And gentlemen, thank you very much for the work you're doing on this. It's innovative. It's creative. Representative Peterson, thank you for taking this on. Clearly, there's more work to be done on this. It's going to go to the General Register today, but I encourage you to work with all the stakeholders before this bill would come up to at least get them neutral or get them to a point where they can sign off on this. You know, like Representative Lane said, I think this is something that we need to probably find a way to make this work. So just encourage you guys to work as hard and as fast as you can to meet the concerns that are out there. With that, members, I'll renew my motion that, I have the DE3 in front of me. House File 2497 be referred to the General Register as amended. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Next on the agenda, House File 2344, Representative Zerwas. Now I'll make a motion that House File 2344 be referred to Public Safety.
Did he bring snacks?
Mr. Chair, I was concerned whether we were in government operations, but I see you have a zero loss bill, so I know I'm in the right spot today.
Welcome to the committee, sir, if you would proceed.
Just here to help. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for moving House File 2344. Mr. Chair, I have two amendments, the A4 and the A5 amendment, if we could move those two amendments.
Okay, I'll move the A4 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all in favor of the A4, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The A4 is adopted. Representative Zerwas, I'll move the A5. Members, any discussion to put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the A5, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, to your bill is amended.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll be brief in respect to the committee's time. This orthotist, prosthetist, easy for me to say, licensure bill deals with licensure for healthcare providers that fit medical equipment for patients that sometimes can be hundreds of thousands of dollars, like a nearly $250,000 artificial limb, or thousands and thousands of dollars for individually specifically made moldings and orthotic braces. The section of law that would fall under this committee for this bill would be Section 4, because within this statute we'd be setting up a advisory committee as part of that. And standard practice, as we set up these licensure bills, there would be an advisory committee to report to the broader health committee that this would report into. The two amendments that we did dealt with cleanup language for the first year's dues payments and how that's going to be worked. And then we cleaned up the penalty section. This is language that was hammered out in Senate Judiciary, and we're just getting the bill prepared for public safety. And with that, members, I do have two testifiers that can give some more background if folks would like. Otherwise, we can just take questions, too. It's your committee, your prerogative, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas, and thank you both the testifiers for being here. Let's see if we have any member questions for the testifiers. Doesn't look like it. I don't know if you have anything that you want to say very briefly. Otherwise, I wouldn't mess up what you have going here right now. any final discussion, any member questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2344 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you,
thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Members, final bill on the agenda, House File 2740, Representative Norton.
We have to.
That's what I said.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Norton.
Thank you.
Thank you for your patience.
Mm-hmm. No wonder you're so happy.
I will move House File 2740 to be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. It looks like you have an author's amendment, Representative Norton.
Yes, I do.
I'll move the A2. Any discussion to put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. I'm not going to go into a great deal of detail about the history, but just know that this has been coming for about 3.5 or 4 years. This particular bill before you is a result of a temporary task force, and we had to make two recommendations. One was for a permanent task force, and one was for some other child support laws, another child support law, which you'll see hopefully on the floor later this year. So before you is a very straightforward permanent task force. The Department of Human Services has to do a quadrennial report every 4 years, and typically this is just done internally, and as so often happens, action isn't always taken on those recommendations by the legislature. So this is going to be a far more inclusive process. We're going to have some legislators, members of the public, and a wide range of others, keeping it within 15 as required by law, to help not only help the department understand the child support issues, but also perhaps help make future changes in law. Many items were recommended by the temporary task force, and this task force will delve into those first and foremost and then get into the quadrennial report. I ask your support for a permanent task force, and I have Melinda Hugdahl here, and either of us are happy and here to answer your questions.
Thank you, Representative Norton, and thank you, Ms. Hugdahl, for being here. Members, any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Norton. The only concern I, reading the title of the bill, the only concern I have is when you talk permanent child support task force, depending how you read that, someone that's going through divorce, it could be looking at that as that my child support is going to be permanent no matter how old my kids get. And I don't know. Just from reading it, that's I have some friends that have had issues with this, that with child support, that may have a heart attack reading that, and I don't think if it would be wise to change that the wording of that slightly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Norton.
Well, we'll look into that. I would say one of the things that we have to do is make certain that the task force, not the child support, is permanent, as it really is being used to help with the quadrennial report, which is ongoing and required by federal law, which is the only reason it's permanent. But we can look into that. Hopefully, it won't cause any confusion.
Representative Scott.
Just real quickly, we could change the title to the Permanent Task Force on Child Support. It's a little wordier, but
there you go.
Yeah.
And we will have this bill heard again, Mr. Chair, and perhaps we can look into that change.
Perfect. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that this is a complex subject that required, there's no perfect solution, and I don't believe this is a perfect solution, but it is better than what we have now, and it's very important to do it.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Any final member questions or comments?
Aye.
Seeing none, Representative Norton.
I'd appreciate a yes vote.
Thank you. With that, members, all in favor, I'll renew my motion that House File 2740 be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance as amended. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Norton. Members, one final piece of business before we go. We had a paperwork error last week, and so we need to bring one bill up for reconsideration. We've already voted and passed on this. The House File 3209, we actually did not have the jackets when we moved through it, so we need to reconsider that. This was the lead shot hunting restriction prohibited, the DNR rulemaking prohibition. We've already voted on it, so I know it was a little more contentious, but all we need to do is reconsider it to match it up with the jackets.
Mr. Chair, I'd make a motion to reconsider House File 3209.
Representative Albright makes a motion that we reconsider House File 3209. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The The motion passes. With that, members, any final discussion to that? Seeing none, House File 3209 will be moved to the General Register. All in favor of that, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Members, with that, we are finished. We do not need to come back this evening. Thank you for all of your work. We are adjourned.